Fake laughing.
I'm fake laughing now. We rehearse laughing, and I just can't get it right, so I'm just faking.
That screaming man never fails to cheer me up. His pain brings me pleasure. It's making me a sadist.
Yeah, it's not enough that we should feel, you know, good. Is that other people should feel bad?
I think it's funny that you were fake laughing. I never knew you had it in you.
I thought I can fake laugh.
Yeah. Are you fake laughing right now?
No. Yes.
Oh my god! It's like when a woman fakes an orgasm. You never know that.
I know, because I always
think now I know how straight men feel when they're women fake orgasms. That's the one good thing about being gay. You can't fake an orgasm.
You can't.
Unless you have like a hidden stash of cream of wheat and like throw it on the window.
Okay. Oh, these are always labeled explicit. We're fine. So, we're back. It is the height of summer here in Doppeltown. And
USA.
USA. And we are we're talking about another book. Which is Thomas M. Dish's The MD, a horror story. That's the subtitle, in case, you know, so that
just
we know.
Just to make sure.
So that we know that it's a horror story.
Yeah, I wasn't sure.
Yeah. Yeah. Apparently it is.
Yeah.
And we picked this book. Actually, I had selected this book. I pulled it off of a shelf a couple weeks ago, about 4 days before Thomas M. Dish died.
That was prescient of you.
Yeah, it was kind of prescient of me.
What if we wrote a horror story about a man who when you pick the book off the shelf, it kills the author in 4 days?
Must probably hasn't been written yet. Get on that. You just go back there and type, I'll talk.
Okay.
Tom Dish, it was kind of sad. He actually killed himself on the 4th of July.
Yeah. He had a rather painful life, it sounds like.
Yeah. It was.
He had chronic pain.
Chronic pain. His longtime partner passed away. Couple years ago, he'd been battling with depression for a long time, and he didn't do it on the spur of the moment. He planned it like
it was like a Hemlock Society kind of thing.
Possibly, he actually filmed a movie with a friend, as you know, talking about it.
Oh, yeah. Did you see the movie?
No,
was it on
no.
YouTube or something.
I don't think so. It premiered at some New York film festival, like Tribeca.
No,
film
it
festival
doesn't.
Or something like that.
Not are you serious?
Too long. Seriously, not too long after he died.
And it was about his. It was about his suicide.
Well, it was about he wrote this long.
That's crazy.
He wrote this long poem about his grieving over the death of Charles Naylor, his partner, and it was about these poems.
Hmm.
And I think it actually kind of touched on his plans.
Wow.
I
think it's because he was a bear.
He was definitely a bear.
Bears are out.
Yeah. And so, yes, he was, Thomas Dish was out since 1968, apparently.
Wow.
Yep.
Yeah. He has Doppeltown connections, doesn't he?
Yeah. Well, he has connections from a town that's very similar to Doppeltown. He actually has connections to the Twin Cities. Oh, is that how we're going to do this? He's saying.
The rules of the game have changed.
Yeah, he
has, checkmate.
He has Duffel Town connections. Yeah, he was born in Des Moines, Iowa, and moved up to Duffel Town, the Twin Cities.
Stop saying that.
I mean, Duffel Town.
You've blown our cover.
Oh, no, son of a... and went to Catholic school.
I'm moving to the Windy City. Can you guess where that is?
Or Shaky Town. and went to a Catholic school. And was a very bright kid.
Well, you know a lot more about him than I do.
I've been reading up on him today. I rarely do research for these things.
You've been Wikipedia besides.
I know. It was a slow day at work.
We need to come up a word for somebody who appears to be knowledgeable from reading Wikipedia.
Oh, that's how I got...
Wikipedia fantastic.
Yeah, that's how I got through graduate school. It wasn't Wikipedia. It was like reading the introductions and the back covers of books.
Mm-hmm. You're Wiccanoing.
Wiccanoing.
No, that sounds more like a wiki knowledge.
Wiki knowledge. But he was primarily known as a science fiction writer. And whereas you can't see this... dear listeners, but Mr. Moncada here next to me is pointing to the relative difference in the levels of our cocktails here.
He has practically drained his, and mine is still filled to the rim.
Actually, tis quite the opposite. You just track the slurs and you see who's telling the truth. But so he was primarily known as a science fiction writer. He wrote a couple of big important sci-fi novels in the late 60s, including a great one called Camp Concentration, which is about political prisoners being kept in a prison and are deliberately infected with this variety of syphilis that makes them smarter as it makes them sicker.
Oh, I've heard of this.
Yeah, it's pretty cool. It would make a fantastic movie. And it's been in print ever since, 68 or 69, whenever it came out.
Which was a weird time to be writing, if you think about it.
It was. He was part of a movement, and this will take us a little bit astray, but we're talking about this author. He was a part of a movement in science fiction called the New Wave, which was a bunch of writers primarily based in
Was Britain. Varley a part of that?
No, he was a little later.
Oh.
He was a little later. The big ones were J.G. Ballard, Michael Moorcock, Thomas Dish, Philip Dick, Harlan Ellison, Robert Silverberg.
Philip Dick.
Ursula Le Guin.
She was New Wave?
Oh, yeah.
So to me, she seems old school at this point.
Yeah, well, she's she kind of does. Well,
they all do.
Before that, science fiction writing was for the most part kind of formulaic, and what they tried to do was actually throw some literary experiments
and characters.
And just do some formal experiments. It's kind of like the same thing that English literature went through in the early 20th century. It's modernism finally came to science fiction in the late 60s, and it was all Michael Moorcock who sort of did that. Norman Spinrad was another writer who was big in that. Anyway, Thomas Dish, this American, was one of the big ones, and was very successful around then. And then he's was put back to pasture. But he worked as a writer. He was a screen. He wrote plays.
Like Night Gallery and stuff like that.
Did he do that? Well, he wrote the novelization of the Prisoner series, series. Yep, he wrote that. And that's still in print. In fact, that'll come leaping back into print again with a new cover when the movie starts, or the new TV series starts. They're remaking that.
It lasts.
If it lasts. Well, it's only...
What channel is it going to be on?
I don't even know. Maybe it's in Britain. If it's in Britain, it'll last.
If it's BBC, it'll last 2 years.
Yeah, it'll begin and it will end.
We'll give it a happy ending.
Yeah.
Not the kind you get at a massage parlor.
Or maybe that too. I apologize for him. See? He's the one with the empty glass.
It's the booze talking.
He was also a poet. Well-respected poet, published widely. He also was the author of one of the first kind of literary text-based computer games. Something called... Oh, I'm going to forget what it's called now. But it was the mid-80s. And it's, you know, it's kind of foundational.
Not Myst.
No, no, it was before Myst. It was strictly text based, but it kind of worked like that. Hmm. It was kind of ambiguous, and but it was all just words on the screen, and you had to make choices.
Boring.
Boring.
I'm already uninterested.
Yeah, I know. But then in the 80s, late 80s, he turned to horror. Oh, he was also a children's writer. He wrote The Brave Little Toaster.
I have never read it.
Yeah, no, it's kind of a famous children's book, and its sequel, The Brave Little Toaster Goes to Mars. So yeah, he was all over the place. I mean, he was really a writer's writer. But like I said,
it didn't make him happy.
Oh, apparently. It really didn't. It really didn't. I think he was kind of malcontent, which makes for good writing.
But perhaps it's what, you know, the whole Margaret Atwood's whole idea that you write out of the melancholy part of your brain.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And he also wrote kind of out of the pissed off part of his brain, because yeah. he was an activist.
He was like a Ginsberg.
Yeah, yeah. He actually kind of looked like Allen Ginsberg.
He kind of did. I thought he kind of did too.
Without the lazy eye.
He was Ginsbergonian.
But. Yeah, so he turned to horror, and we picked up... I never read any of his horror books. I really just read some of his sci-fi stuff. And I always wanted to, and I was delighted to find out that all four of his horror books are set in Doppeltown.
Yeah.
And this is his second one.
Which is not known for being a horrible city.
No, it's rather benign for the most part.
It is. It needs a little dash of horror.
A little dash of horror. So this kind of turned me on, so... I snagged this book, and this was kind of a bestseller. Apparently, according to the yellow type across the top here, it says it is the terrifying national bestseller.
I have to say, I didn't think this book was horror, but that's okay.
Well, it says here, right in the subtitle.
I don't care.
You horror can't. Story.
It's not. I didn't think it was a horror story.
I don't think so either. It was dark fantasy.
It was dark fantasy.
Yeah,
whatever that is.
But this is dark.
I don't even know.
This
anymore.
Is dark fantasy before the word. You know, before they invented the word for
fantasy.
Dark fantasy. Anyway, so we picked it up and read it. Okay, the end.
It's cocktail time.
What are we gonna have this week? Anyway, so
we should fess up because I read this book I finished it way before you did.
Yeah,
you were very slow on the uptake for some reason.
Well, I was sitting on it waiting. I was sitting on it waiting for you to start it, and I should never ever do that because I wait till you start it. I started it before you did.
No, you didn't.
I was about 100 pages in.
I started before you did.
Well, whatever. But once you start something, it's like drinking the spittoon. Once you start, you just can't stop until it's all gone. But for me, I just, you know, I was kind of
you lollygagged.
I lollygagged. Yeah, no, I got
you took it like a summer saunter through it, and I did like the winter race down the street to the car.
Hope the cat down. That's more Doppeltown talk for you there. I took me a long time to read it. But not because I didn't like it.
I thought it was because you didn't like it.
I just kept getting distracted.
You like it, but it didn't hold you.
That's true.
And that is the essence of this book.
Yes. It had the feature of some books that is really dangerous for me as a reader. It's broken up into very distinct sections with
two
big dime.
At least
big,
two.
No, there's five. There's
right. five. For me, it was two.
Oh yeah. Well, you didn't like that. Yeah. Everything
was golden before
book five. I think it was. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. No, but it breaks up and so when I reach an ending point, I just go and pick up another manga.
But frankly, it really was two sections.
Oh yes.
I mean, it could have been five books, but it was really two. A line was drawn.
Yeah.
And that book totally shifted.
Yeah. Yeah.
To I don't know where the hell it went.
Well, it's kind of funny because I think my guess is that he was writing this book. He had the ideas for it, and he was writing this stuff, and he was kind of doing... I mean, some of this seems vaguely autobiographical. Well, first of all, he did grow up in Doppeltown. He did go to a Catholic school like our protagonist, Billy Williams.
You know what Catholic school he went to?
I don't. Wait a minute. You know, it's you can find us on Wikipedia, but you know, it's not that important.
It is to me, but that's okay.
But we'll find out on our own time. No, it does say which one.
Okay.
In the Wikipedia page. Okay. And it, his depiction of growing up in Doppeltown in the 60s, late 50s, 60s, it's kind of weird. I mean, what was your experience of reading that? Did it seem like
it could have been? It didn't really matter.
Yeah, some of the street names, it was funny.
The street names were so wrong.
Well, some of them were right and some of them were wrong. Yeah. So you could guess, like,
it was like Anywhere USA, kind
of. Yeah, well, there's some of the depictions, like they go to a bar at some point, which is on the corner of Snelling and something. And that's about three blocks from where we're sitting here in state-of-the-art Forbidden Book Group's studios. And there are bars there. And I'm thinking, oh, I wonder which one that is. Is it that obnoxious college bar, or is it, it is the obnoxious college bar. And the state fairgrounds figures prominently in at least the last section.
All right.
Don't you remember?
No.
That's where the concentration camp is located.
Oh, yeah.
And he describes specific buildings in the state fairgrounds, which are still there.
I plowed through that. I wanted to get done with the end of the book that I plowed through that. I missed the nuances.
I'm going to defend the end of the book in a little while. All right. I didn't hate it.
I didn't hate it.
You just thought it.
I lost interest.
You dropped the ball and went skittering off, and you did some deer, like chasing it.
Yeah. So the premise of the book is that this boy is really in cahoots with a god.
Yeah.
Now, like, he takes on the guise of Santa Claus.
Yes.
But it turns out that he's the god Mercury or Hermes. Actually.
Hermes. Probably.
Or he could be old Nick.
Yeah.
Or
Satan. Or he could be
whoever. Who else? He's who knows?
He is just some. He's some supernatural force.
And he takes on many guises, yeah, in some ways. Jesus,
yeah.
And
yeah, he becomes a televangelist at one point.
Yeah, so he reminds me a lot of Stephen King's the character in The Stand.
Oh,
he reappears over and over again. The walking man.
The walking dude.
Yeah.
But it's
a Faustian bargain because the little boy is sort of tricked into getting a. The stick with the bird.
I pronounce that Caduceus. I've heard people pronounce it Caduceus.
I thought it was Caduceus.
Caduceus?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Sounds more Roman to me.
Yeah. Caduceus. Well, yeah. So pick whatever spelling you want, but it's the symbol of the medical profession. It's that staff with the twined snakes and the wings.
Thus, M.D.
The M.D., yeah. And there's a... and what his actual talisman is this twined sticks that kind of look like a snake, and there's a dead, desiccated sparrow attached to the top of it.
Right, and it gives him the power to heal, and it gives him the power to curse, basically.
Yeah, to heal and to curse, and they have to happen in equal portions.
Yeah, for it to be powerful enough to. So he makes so here's this young boy given this power to.
Yeah, and how young is he at the beginning? He's very young.
7 or 8.
Yeah, he's a smart kid.
He makes huge mistakes.
Oh, my God. Yes. The first mistake, the first mistake he makes is to basically trap his brother in kind of like Terry Schiavo's body.
Yeah, he's in a comatose state.
Yeah, he seems to be in a persistent vegetative state.
But he's alert.
But you don't find out until the very end that he is in there. And he can see
what's going on. Assumed that he was in there. I assumed from the beginning that...
I couldn't tell.
Yeah. I always assumed that he knew exactly what was going on, but he was in this state.
That's horrible.
Yeah, so basically it's his dealings with figuring out this power as a boy... Takes him in the first half of the book. He really is up to like 8-9 years old.
Yeah. Well, at the very end, before he's an adult, the very last section that you didn't particularly care for, He is like 14, maybe 13, yeah, something like something that.
He's like a burgeoning on teenage.
Yeah, and he's starting to get a moral sense, and he's actually he's old enough to make somebody pregnant. We do know that.
Yes,
he does. So he's probably like, I'm guessing he's 14. I'm guessing he's 14.
So what? Yeah. So then the book then takes a turn. In that he goes from 14. Now we see him as an adult.
Yeah,
he's an MD.
He's very wealthy.
He's very wealthy, and he's and through the power of this talisman, he's created a disease.
Yes,
that is
Arvids.
That will that he's also creating the cure for.
Yes,
to make money.
Yes,
but also to create power.
Yeah, to make money, to create, to gain power, and he does at least tell himself that he has an altruistic motive, which is the planet is sick, and that disease is humanity, and it needs to be, it needs a little chemo.
So this is interesting because we're talking a lot about the plot of the book, which we usually do with the book
that we don't know how to talk about.
Yeah. So what is it because right,
it's
been?
I'll get into the juice.
So is it because it's been a long time that we read it?
It has been.
Reminding ourselves.
It has been a long time. We're trying to get each other on the same page. Clearly, we need to. But no, I mean, I do have some things I guess I can say about the book. Some observations. I kind of want to defend the last part.
All right, I'll go into bitching about the last
part. All right, you begin by bitching.
I thought that, to me, it came to a messy, up until the very end, it was this craptastic hodgepodge of this boy who's crazy and the preacher on the TV who isn't really there and it's the God this disease and the money and the...
This is all the last
bloody, bloody, blue. And it was like, what the hell happened to this book? It was...
You know, if the last part...
The very end of the book, of course... There's sort of this unraveling of all the curses, which I found great.
Yeah.
I love that.
Yeah.
But everything up until that point, it was like, what the hell?
He was getting his comeuppance. Faust was paying his, you know, he had gotten his knowledge.
But frankly, the seeds of that were nowhere in the first part of the book, that he would create this disease.
No, not really.
And that's what bugged me, is that it just sort of like stopped and was a... It was like two different books, two different characters.
Kind of. He does the seeds are planted. The first part of the book. See, the book is there's a fulcrum right between the fourth and the fifth section.
Hold on a second. It's not the first part of the book. It's the first three quarters of the book.
That's the point I'm making. There's a fulcrum in the book, but it is not in the freaking middle, and that is. That's tough. That's, you know, it takes the first four books, the first four sections of this novel, have to weigh against the last section.
And it was all too fast.
It seems lopsided.
It seems forced. It seems like something was extruding sausage through a small opening.
Forced meat.
It was forced meat. It really was.
But the last section, in and of itself, I think you're giving. I think you're giving a short shrift. I think it was actually quite tightly plotted. In fact, it holds together in and of itself much better than some of the other sections do. I suspect that it
holds together, but not for the first three quarters of the book. It might hold together for another book.
Yeah.
Where do you see this child having this thing about the money and the disease and sort of ridding humanity? Yeah. Where do you see that?
Yeah, he's
the seeds of that in the first three quarters of the book. Well, I don't see
They're kind of there because he has this desire that he demonstrates throughout, which actually he doesn't demonstrate. It kind of grows in him. From the very beginning, when he makes his first miracles And ends up sending, you know, he saves all the elm trees, which is speaking directly to the great elm, Dutch elm disease, which wiped out most of the trees in the Twin... Doppeltown.
Stop it!
Stop it! In Doppeltown, back around that time. And he saves, like, the trees in his park and his backyard, which is a good thing. But also, and equally impulsively, he curses his half-brother to this lifetime. Literally a lifetime.
And his grandma loses her hair.
His grandma loses her hair. Just
so people because, get dental disease.
Oh, yeah. He makes these moral choices that like an 8-year-old would make. You know, these bullies are picking on me.
Well, he's goaded into it.
Yeah. And so he, early on, you see that he makes these moral choices and imposes them on other people, which is being awfully hubristic. It's being awfully self-important, which little kids are. And he was given the power. He was given the power to do
and
it.
And interestingly enough, it was at around 7, because he was first grade.
Yeah.
Right? Which is in the Catholicism, that's the age of reasoning.
Mm-hmm.
That you are sort of accountable for your decisions.
Yeah. One of the seeds, another seed that was planted, it was near the very end of the fourth section, which is when he kind of figures out the middle road. On how to deal moral retribution on that. What was it? The guy who wouldn't float him a couple, like 25 cents for, was it some chips, some gum, some milk or something? I can't remember what it was. Some shop owner. He's been going in there for, you know, years. And this guy knows him, but he's a cranky old dude. He's having a bad day. And he realizes that he's forgotten, you know, 25 cents. Can you do me a solid and, you know, just give this to me? I'll catch you tomorrow. You know I'm going to be here. And the guy won't do it, and that really cheeses him off. And so he cooks up a curse. And when he cooks up that curse, he realizes that he doesn't make it explicit in that section, but he says, you know, I think he's figured something out. This is how I'm going to use this power. I'm going to you know, cook up this curse and also have the power to retract it.
Yep.
Which is what Arvid's is. He has the curse, he has the cure, and he profits from it. But he's not, I mean, he lets these people die. Mm-hmm. And they get in that last section they talk about the concentration camps, where people are just herded in and left to they're just stored until they die, and at some point, apparently he never gets to this. At some point, he's going to issue the cure, and be the savior, but not before he profits hugely by land speculation and
pharmaceuticals
and all kinds of stuff. Yeah, it's kind of a this was published in 91. It's pretty. We talk about pharmaceutical companies today, but I think people talked about it back then. But this is right on the nose.
Yeah, the creating a disease that you cure, like a designer disease.
Yeah, designer disease, or like not researching something you can't make money on, like lithium, because we talked about this in one earlier episode. Lithium's an element. It's also a useful drug to treat people with cyclothymic or bipolar disorder, or at least it was.
They still use it,
but you can't patent it because it's an element. So why do the research? And they did do the research for most of the 20th century. So, and although they knew, they had a pretty good idea that it was effective for these diseases.
Shame.
Bastards. I'm going to climb down off my high horse now. Man.
You, where are you? You're so way up there.
I don't know. My nose bleeding. Anyway, I don't know. You want to run down the last section some more?
Go ahead. Dom.
I wanted to...
I know. I did the I like the unworking of the curses. It reminded me a lot of those movies, that movie that had the final, where people die,
Final Destination?
Yeah. It reminded me a lot of that.
Really? Well, I've never seen those.
Yeah. So, you know, for instance, the mother who is an alcoholic, he cures her of alcoholism.
Yes.
That unravels.
And
she goes just gets drunk, yeah, and falls into the lake and drowns.
Falls into Lake Calhoun and drowns.
The boy who was cursed to be in coma wakes up, but then he dies.
Yeah, well, he torches the house.
Yeah, he just torches the house. Yeah,
burns everything just down.
Furious.
And all the elm trees
die. The lady grows her hair. The old lady
grows.
Grandma. Well, he cursed them.
Schmecker.
He cursed them with having long health.
Yeah,
but then they.
She accidentally, he curses like a coin or something like that. Whoever picks this coin up, or this whatever this thing is, the hair will fall out. Originally, he was going to use it on his dad or his stepdad.
Yeah, he was mad at his stepdad.
And he decides not to do that, but he doesn't keep track of that thing that he cursed. And Grandma Obstmecker, which means fruit taster. loses all of her hair. But yes, but her hair starts growing out at the end.
And then she dies. And the potted plants in the house die.
Yep.
And the boy grows his tongue back.
Mm-hmm.
So that was fun to see all that unraveling as the main character is getting his intestines pulled out. And
there's
a very gruesome...
There was a gruesome thing at the end there.
His son is just the bender. And
yeah, the sins of the father are visited upon the son. And so he's got a son who is a fundamentalist. He's a believer in the unbelievable. He believes in this TV preacher. Actually, it's an internet preacher who we know doesn't exist, and he's just a program. He's just a sim, but this kid's faith is so strong that nothing will shake it. Even though he's like people who programmed the sim say, you know, this is just a sim. The God who had helped his father takes the persona of Reverend. I can't remember his name.
Otis or
something like that, and ends up giving him the kid the power,
which he has for a very short amount of time.
Yeah,
I like that. I liked the way I like this depiction of this god and how it's this tricky. It's like a Loki, tricky. Mm-hmm. It's really out for its own.
Yeah,
it wants to be worshipped. And it gives with one hand and it takes with the other.
Yeah. Yeah.
And
yeah.
It seduces at young age and pulls you in. And that depiction I found very compelling.
Yeah.
And especially that first part of that book where that kid is really sort of sussing out his moral compass.
Yeah.
And he's given this great power.
Yeah.
And trying to figure out how to use it. And I really thought he was not going to go in that direction.
And so that
second half of the book was very jarring.
I agree. It's the I too very much preferred the first four sections of the book because the kid is as kids go through these as they try to do the good, the right thing. But they end up screwing up and their main excuse is I'm only trying to help.
And he has no one to guide him and no one to sort of teach him about this other than this god.
Yeah, he's
really is in it for its power's sake.
Yeah, he likes the chaos, I think. I kind of want to. It's amazing. I hadn't thought of this until we started recording this, but this is without a doubt intentionally and through the Faust story.
Yeah,
because Faust. What was Faust's profession? What was
he? Was a doctor.
He was a doctor. That just occurred to me. I'm like, now that I think of that, the whole book rearranges itself in my head. It's like, of course, this is Faust. Faust does not make a deal with the devil because he wants to do evil.
No, he wants to do good.
He wants to do good.
And he thinks he's doing good, and his whole moral world
is
fractured in a way.
Yeah, you know, the Faust story is one of the. The cornerstones of the history of Gothic and horror literature. And until now, we don't think we've ever touched on it. It's Clive Barker's favorite story. I mean, Hellraiser is the Faust story. The Damnation Game is the Faust story. I haven't read a lot of Clive Barker, but Clive Barker himself is very upfront saying that the story of Faust is his most... it's one of his most appealing to him, and he comes back to it over and over again.
Well, now I'm looking through all our things, thinking, well, does Faust show up in any of these?
I can think of one.
Books. I think possibly the book about the woman, the writer.
The End of Alice.
The End of Alice.
Well, I was going to say, Michael Sisko's The Divinity Student is one.
Yep.
I would say some of Thomas Ligotti's stories about these academics who are... looking into secrets that they shouldn't find out about, and it costs them their soul.
Maybe Brian Wilson Aldiss's Frankenstein Unbound.
Yeah. You know, actually, the Frankenstein story is actually kind of a...
Joe Hill's Heart-Shaped Box, definitely there was a Faustian bargain in there, kind of. But this is probably the most explicit of the Faustian bargains. Yeah. And
there may actually be an argument that David Lindsay's voiced Arcturus is a Faust story, but
remotely.
That's
an archetypal story, isn't it? I mean, like making a deal...
Yeah.
I mean, probably before Faust. I mean, there was making a deal with the gods. I mean, Pandora or
Prometheus.
Maybe in a way, Prometheus. I mean, in a way.
Yeah.
And the gods are making deals with each other all the time. Yeah. And they get screwed.
Yeah.
Tricked. The apples, the golden apples.
I'm trying to think what Thomas Dish gains by making the identity of the guy, the other side of the bargain, the god who has the power to make the deal, by making it ambiguous. Is he Mercury? Is he Santa Claus? Is he the devil? Is he this televangelist? In all the previous versions, it's the devil. And the devil's motives are pretty transparent.
Is it the devil or is it a devil?
Or a devil. But in the MD, in Thomas Dish's book, we don't know. I mean, at one point, what can we get? What do we gain if we consider Santa Claus to be a Faustian negotiator?
Well,
I think it's fascinating
because that is Santa Claus.
That is Santa Claus.
You make it. There is a trade.
There is a trade.
You sit on Santa's lap.
Here's the deal.
And really, I mean I think the god of our culture is very much a sort of, I'm going to pray my wish list, and in exchange, I'll do such and such, and then I'll get my wishes.
I know.
Well, let's say this thing isn't really let's say that Thomas Dish isn't talking about God per se, a god.
Yeah.
But he's talking about a force.
Yeah.
Right?
That
you bargain with, and in the end, you get screwed.
Mm-hmm.
You bargain with this thinking that you have power, but in the end it is reversed, the great reversal. What is that?
That is...
What could he be referring to?
I don't know.
Is it life?
It's education. It's the illusion that you can change the world.
Yeah, so is it your...
But in the... I mean, everybody... Yeah, yes, you can change the world. And he does. But in the end, the contract is up. And you end up,
Well, he does change the world, but does he better the world? And apparently not.
Am I feeling cynical today? I'm going to say maybe. But he makes a lot of misery.
He makes mostly misery.
He
makes a fake disease that kills a lot
of... Yeah. Because a lot of people. And so it turns the country into, 1984. It turns it into a police state where, you know, you can't, the downtown, if you are not from around here, you are automatically suspect. You know, the scene that opens up the fifth section, it is his real father coming back from Canada where he was a draft dodger.
Yeah.
He's coming back from Canada. He has Arvids. And he gets picked up by a down-home northern Minnesota country, just a farmer, who picks him up in his pickup truck and he's hitchhiking. And the farmer is very friendly, but the farmer has pegged him as an Arvids case and is going to take him to the nearest detention center.
Yeah.
The father ends up shooting this guy in the head and dumping his body and stealing his truck. But that was shocking from the first 350 pages of the book to the end. It was a big change in Doppeltown culture, I'll say. Anyway.
Yeah, I think that it, I think it's not so much about gods, but it's about anything that promises us power.
Yeah.
That there's an exchange, and in the end, the things that give us power will eventually unravel us. And yeah. I think that's what I think he's getting at, and he uses the characters and
the price is
that Faust, or does Faust talk more about our egos, which I guess gives us power?
Yeah,
our egos give us power.
Yeah, the price of this kind of power is so close to equaling the price of, you know, the evil of the power is so close to even.
I suppose it's that power corrupts.
Yeah,
and it's an absolute power.
Yeah, and that's corrupts. very much the case in this book.
I mean, and that as humans, we don't have the capacity to wield that power. Yeah. I mean, we do, but there's consequences.
Yeah. I mean, you look at his life at the end here. His sister has become a sort of a Dorothy Day character, sort of this nun with a kid, mm-hmm. and his son, who he doesn't acknowledge, but everybody knows is his kid, is just a complete freaking wacko who undoes everything.
Yeah.
He himself gets hoisted on his own petard. Because
he gets Arvids.
Yeah, well, he gets...
Or he gets an appendix.
He gets... he gets detained as an Arvids patient.
Yeah.
And he gets ground up in the machinery that he made. Yeah. Basically, it's very similar to all the controversy that's going on today about the TSA and airport screening. About little people with small imaginations and power trips can completely unravel a person.
Oh, yeah.
Trying to get through airport security.
Yeah.
Well, he basically gets caught into one of these things where it's an Arvids thing, and somebody, some little person, has basically given this person a lot of power. And she uses it against him, not knowing who he is. And he is caught in the machine, and he takes him, I don't know, a week to get out.
Yeah.
Meanwhile, his appendix is getting, and he has to go through, you know, meatball surgery at the state fairgrounds concentration camp, and it ends up, you know, he gets really sick and
yeah.
But also everything he does just unravels everything.
And that's the deal with power and your own.
Mm-hmm.
It sort of made him the center of the universe, power.
And
it's not able to hold him.
It's actually kind of sad because you're reading this book and you have the kid in your mind, you know, pretty strongly,
right?
And then you see what's become of him and how empty his life is. I mean, his wife was a great piece of work. She's everything's hunky dory, everything's wonderful. The house is really nice, and she's going to the fundraisers and everything like that. And as soon as she gets a whiff that everything is going south, she says, "Well, it was a good run. I am out of here. I am gone.
Yeah.
Not even a note. Yeah. Send the kids out east. I got a plane ticket." She doesn't make it, you know. But yeah, and, you know, it's nothing personal. But, you know, I was living your lie, and the lie has been
been
unraveled.
So, you know, I'm out of here.
Yeah.
How hollow his life was at the end.
Yeah. And you don't really see the seeds of that in the beginning.
King. Yeah.
The other thing, though, is that the father, the dead, which I kind of thought was interesting, is the dead father.
Yes. Because
really his hand is in this. And you're not quite sure in the end how his father, his dead father, made this happen, but you get the sense of that the father did do this.
Yeah.
That unmade this.
Unmade this.
Because he saw where this guy was headed and what was happening.
Yeah.
And
I almost wonder if in some of the more classic Faust's tellings, the Christopher Marlowe one or the Goethe one, if there isn't a figure like that that Thomas Dish is specifically trying to evoke with that father figure, I don't know. I mean, I read the Marlowe one years and years and years ago, and I've never read the Goethe one, but that almost makes me think that he's specifically alluding to something in the Faust tradition.
Yeah, I have no idea.
Yeah, it'd be worth investigating.
I do think, in a way, it's interesting that sort of like the dead ancestor. I mean, there's a correction.
Yeah,
I mean, the world gets rebalanced. He dies, mm-hmm. and things go back. Even though this god tries to pass his power into somebody else, and it ends up futile.
It ends up a non-starter because he tries to pass it on to. His son, Judge, and Judge almost makes it, but
doesn't quite
make it.
Yeah.
And so that that apparently is supposed to be the end. Now, wasn't there a sort of an after the credits little ominous thing at the very last page?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So there's a zombie left. Dun, dun,
dun. Well, there's that thing of who are you bowing? Because God makes these people bow down and worship him and give. Mm-hmm. And pledge their troth to them,
their oath of fealty,
there's a cautionary tale. What are you going to pledge to?
Yeah, what are you going to pledge to?
Yeah,
yeah. How? What is your altruism worth? How much evil are you willing to?
Well, I mean, you think about current situations as they are and how some of these people were duped into thinking, must be duped into thinking they're doing good.
Yeah. Yeah.
And that there is a bargain. You know, all these people in Iraq will die,
mm-hmm.
but we will, free a country.
Free a country. Right
the wrong of 9/11, even though that's erroneous.
Yeah, or even going back further, a more... to us, clear-cut example of Nazi Germany. I honestly think Adolf Hitler thought he was doing the right thing.
You do?
Adolf Hitler thought he was doing the right thing. And that was what made him so unspeakably evil.
Right, you can't trust people who tell you they're doing the right thing.
Yeah.
That's the lesson of
him. Yeah, people who are that sure of their moral standing... You really have to watch out for. You have to watch out for those people. Yeah. So that's where our friend Billy William ends up in this book, and it all comes together at the end. I don't know that he really realizes that the bill of goods he was sold.
I thought he sort of accepted it.
Yeah, you think so?
Yeah, I think he sort of wanted it to be done.
Yeah,
at some point, but that was
even at the very end there when his shady land deals up around Lake Mille Lacs they're about to be exposed by this grossly overweight state senator,
corpulent
state senator. He's just like, oh, this guy's going to be easy. He's going to drop dead of a heart attack real soon, and anybody can look at him and see that it's not going to be surprised. Well, that doesn't happen.
He curses. He curses something, and he holds on to it.
Yeah,
he wants to use it later.
It ends up with the woman who railroaded him into the concentration camp.
Yeah,
but you see him make this decision super quickly, and you realize just how corrupted He has become. He has become. And it's kind of shocking.
What was your, what do you think was the, what's your favorite part of the book?
My favorite part of the book is the Halloween section.
Really?
Simply because, the spectacle of that whole bowl of cursed Halloween candy. Yeah. rotting the teeth out of the bullies from the other school was, I was a kid once. I actually went to one of those Halloween, those keep the kids off the streets and so they don't bite into any razor blades. Let's go do trick or treating at school parties. Yeah. So that was really clear in my mind. And we had bullies in our neighborhood and I had very uncharitable thoughts about them when I was in 9 years
old. Oh, yeah. You want to see the bullies come up then.
Yeah, and they get it. And especially because he didn't drop that thread. That bully that loses all of his teeth shows up later as a moral man, as a preacher.
Yeah.
Which I thought was great.
I thought that was really great. My favorite part was, I had two. One was with the kite scene.
Yes.
Which was...
with that same bully.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And the strings and the kite and the fingers and the
tooth. Yeah. And he tries to bite the string of the kite because...
And it gets caught in his teeth and it
pulls... And a gust of wind comes along.
And pulls. And my second piece was... favorite piece was the death of the mother and the drunk father on the boats on Lake Calhoun.
I know, because, I didn't feel bad about that.
No, because, she died happy.
She's reunited with this man that she loved, and they were just pulled apart by forces. And at the end, they came full circle, and they were deliriously happy.
I also liked the grandma losing her hair. That was my other... I did not like that grandma at all.
You didn't like her?
No.
She was great. She was. She reminded me of... she's a very recognizable to me upper Midwestern... character.
Yeah, absolutely.
I've been related to those people.
Yes. I thought of your family actually with that.
Yeah.
What do you think that the what do you think was the this kid, he makes this bargain, what do you think was the attraction to a 7-year-old kid to want this?
I don't know.
What would you have done?
Oh, I don't know. I think the attraction for the kid, and I think the thing that attracted the god to him was something to do with that elaborate miniature bowling pin play that he was staging in his room. Remember that?
Mm-hmm.
He had this huge war going on between these imaginary kingdoms, like the Kingdom of Wyomia.
Mm-hmm.
And had all these characters. I mean, this is like this 8-year-old kid had this whole thing set up like a bunch of crusty Victorian war gamers.
Yeah.
And he would he had this whole thing plotted out, and the plot would move forward. This rich fantasy life. Something about that made him a good candidate.
Mm-hmm.
But what would I have done as a 7-year-old?
I suppose in another, if you think about it, this book is also about sort of the curse of imagination.
It's the curse of imagination, yeah. I mean, this kid, he's a 7-year-old. He's not an 11-year-old like Harry Potter, but he is offered the same deal that Harry Potter gets.
In a way, yeah.
In a way. He's like
magical.
Yeah, he's like, guess what? Your life isn't a humdrum living under the...
You're special now.
You are special. You are a special kid. And these are your powers. You don't know them yet. You don't know how to use them. But here are some of the... Here's your first lesson.
So the interesting thing in Harry Potter, there's lots of guidance.
Lots of guidelines.
And in this one, there's zero.
Yeah. And the Force that... Because the Force
that... is sinister.
The Force that grants it is sinister.
And self-serving,
yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. So,
Would you have taken the bargain?
Oh, yeah. As a 7-year-old?
Yeah.
Oh, hell yeah.
If it was Santa Claus, probably.
Yeah, I remember. I mean, compare this bargain, which was offered to both of us, I'm sure. Not when I was 7 years old, but probably when I was 12. You're at church, or you're going to your CCD, and a visiting priest comes in and says, "Consider if you have a vocation. You can become you can have the power to grant absolution. You know, you can have these magical powers if you become a priest. And I seriously thought about it. I was like, cool, magical powers. That'd be awesome. Plus, I get to go to heaven.
I totally wanted magical powers when I was a kid. I absolutely, fundamentally wanted magical powers.
Oh, yes.
And still do.
And so this seven-year-old gets them, tries them out. They freaking work.
And he loves it.
And he loves it. Yeah. What seven-year-old kid wouldn't grab that?
Yeah.
So, I mean, I don't blame William for...
No, it's a human condition.
It's a human condition.
What do you think of Dish's writing style?
I like it.
What do you like about it?
I like his. He's very plain spoken. He once in a while he'll have a wonderful, really wonderful turn of phrase, but behind it all is this really kind of nasty wit.
Yeah.
There's some nastiness. Which is very appealing.
Yeah.
And I remember that wit from the earlier books that I read of his. This book has made me vow to read some more. I kind of want to read some of his early sci-fi stuff, but I mostly want to read... he has four of these books set in Doppeltown. The Businessman is the first one. The MD is the second one.
The priest
is the third one, and the fourth one is called The Sub. It's about a teacher. And they're all careers.
Maybe that it's all careers. Speaking of careers, if I was going to become a bartender...
what would you...
And use? A watchmaker.
And a watchmaker.
I would have to say, it's cocktail time! What aren't we drinking right now?
Well, this is about the MD, so this drink is going to be very tonic.
It's not supposed to taste good.
It's called this drink is called the Doctor's Orders. And what goes in? This is a shot. We're not going to make you drink a whole tumbler.
Right,
of this.
It's a shot. It's a hold your nose shot.
It has a dribble of chartreuse.
Mm-hmm.
A dribble of Pernod, and a dribble of Aquavit.
Uh-huh.
Hold your nose, shoot it back, you'll feel better in the morning. Doctor's orders.
I'm breathing.
It's really clear.
It's almost like
lungs.
Vicks for your innards.
It's making my eyes water a little bit, and my ears are declaring.
You can also freeze it and use it as a suppository.
Yes, you could. No. I actually wouldn't recommend doing that. I would not, especially forbid you to do that. So there it is. Doctor's orders.
I don't want it.
Take it. It's good for you.
I think since we've done that and we're running out of time, we should head down to the old Delta Town. The old Forbidden Book Group
Library Vault,
and see what's a doing.
All right, let's go. Oh, it's still dark down here.
It's still here. Let me light a match.
All right. Why? Exactly?
Why didn't you pay the electric bill? Damn you!
Why exactly are you lighting that match? This dehumidifier has been running for
it's
weeks.
It's a Fardian bargain.
Fardian bargain.
So what should we read? What have we even decided about reading?
Let's go over to this new section here, the new arrivals, which we haven't actually looked at for a while. So it's getting kind of stacked up here. But
A B C D
Dexter. There's a whole bunch of books about some guy named Dexter. Should we read the Dexter books?
You know, we should, since we already did.
Since we already did, and may
if I predict our future, we have already read it.
And I have had a very insightful discussion about it.
Much better than this. So who wrote Dexter Stories?
It's by Jeffrey Lindsay. Yeah. And
why is this forbidden?
It's forbidden because most people watch the TV show instead of read the book. So god dang it, we're going to read. Yeah. We're going to read all three of the ones that are currently published. I hear tell there's a fourth one on the way.
Dexter in the Dark. Dreaming.
Darkly Dreaming Dexter is the first
Dreaming
one.
Dexter.
Dearly Devoted Dexter is the second one. And Dexter in the Dark is the third.
And I'm just saying Dexter.
Yeah, just Dexter books.
Dexter.
Very good. So read those up, read those down, and be prepared to discuss.
They're quick reads, and beware of the second one. All I can say is mashed potatoes.
Yeah, mashed potatoes. Potato Man.
So there you go.
There you have
it. Let's get the hell out of this dungeon here.
Yeah, all right.
And here we are. So that was dank and musty.
Yeah, I know.
I think I'm in the other shot of the Doctor's Orders.
Doctor's Orders, that's right, as a purgative. We've talked this book down.
I have nothing more to say about this book.
Does this book make you want to read some of his other horror books? You want to read The Priest, admit it.
I think I would want to read The Priest.
Yeah.
Just because.
Maybe next year this time we'll pull down another Thomas Tisch book. You know, I'm very sad that he's gone, actually.
I am. I've been
sort of following him and reading what he does for a while. So he died the same day that Jesse Helms died. And who got all the news?
The world was rebalanced on that one.
Exactly. So, jeez. Bam.
Anything in the horror world that you wanted to talk about? Or
I don't know. We're still talking about going up to the World Horror Con in Winnipeg. Not really. I've been reading a manga series called Yugasagi Corpse Delivery Service by A.G. Otsuka.
Oh, fun.
Which is fantastic. It's fantastic. I highly recommend it.
That sounds good.
It's got a very definite Buffy vibe to it, so I'm going to slide those your way.
Cool. I just read a book called The Medium, which is about a girl in the world during World War II. Uh-huh. It has medium powers.
Cool.
It's pretty good, actually. It's pretty good.
All right.
I would recommend it. I can't remember who wrote it, but I recommend it.
The Medium.
Medium.
Yeah, just type in the... going to
Amazon. It's not the TV show.
Yeah, so type in Medium and then just stay away from DVDs and you'll probably find it.
I just recorded my first commentary episode for Buffy Between the Lines.
Really?
Yeah. Wow. And I think I might have an in the Angel Between the Lions series.
We'll see.
You
know, I'm embarrassed to say I haven't listened to any of these yet, but I'm going to.
So,
all right.
That's the end of it.
We're done, then. Yeah. So, what do we do at the end?
We put a steak in its...
You know, I'm going to go for some steak.
Let's put a steak through its kidneys. Steak and kidneys.
Steak and kidneys. Yeah, we'll make a little pie.
Chop off its head cheese.
With garlic.
Yeah.
Steak and kidneys with some garlic. And put it in our mouth.
Yeah. And chop off its head cheese.
Its head cheese.
All right.
Bam. We're done.
That's all we got.
Goodbye. I'm out of here.
Bye.
It's me. I went to see the doctor today, 'cause ever since you've been gone, I had a pain deep down inside. He says there's nothing really wrong with me, I'm just missing my man. So honey, please, come on home as soon as you can. Doctor's order say there's only one thing for me. He's prescribed a potion for
you understand how I feel, honey? I know you got a lot of things on your mind. Oh, but I'm missing you so bad.